Canadian Dr. David Suzuki has been spreading bad news for quite a long time now about global warming and environmental degradation. The Cassandra of conservation. Dr. Suzuki has a hard scientific background to confound his detractors. He's a geneticist. His 1976 book, An Introduction to Genetic Analysis, remains the most widely used text in the United States. He's a renowned broadcaster, radio and television, an international authority on sustainable ecology. Last year, he retired as professor in the Department of Zoology and Sustainable Development Research Institute at the University of British Columbia, but continues to be active in the Vancouver-based David Suzuki Foundation, dedicated to the study of the human impact on the environment. Oh, and a heap of books as well. He's here for Writers and Readers Week, and I asked him, what if we have, in the area of environmental degradation, past the point of no return?
Well, I don't think anybody can say that. And, you know, every time we lose a species, it's gone forever. So that's a little hole in the fabric of the web of life. And we have no idea at what point you get a critical passage. In Canada, in 1992, the government finally called a total moratorium on all fishing for northern cod off the coast of Newfoundland, put 45,000 people out of work overnight. That was supposed to be a two-year moratorium. 10 years later, the fish haven't come back. So there's a simple example of where an environmental collapse really went beyond the capacity of nature to come back. So we have no idea.
Although in The Naked Ape to Superspecies, in a chapter called Complex Pleasures, you say, we're messing up the planet, we've messed it up already, we're running out of time, and we have to fight despair. Now, that's a dilemma that you and others who warn of doom face, the apathy of helplessness, panic paralysis.
Absolutely, absolutely. People ask me, they say, listen, you've been doing this for over 35 years, how do you keep your spirits up? And all I can say is that at the same time that I've been taking the message out there, I have also been reveling in the nature that we do have and going out and renewing my batteries whenever I can out in the natural world. But I have grandchildren. I have a commitment into the future. And I don't ever want to have them look me in the eye and say, Grandpa, you could have done more. So I have no choice but to soldier on, knowing I'm not going to save the world. My foundation is not going to save the world. But millions and millions of insignificant people trying to do their best, I think, can add up to something.
You're a geneticist. You were a geneticist. How do you respond to people who say, look, if we can just get the technology together, we will invent, you know, the never-ending tree?
I agree. And, you know, the problem is that there are even scientists who are on the right side, like E.O. Wilson and Peter Raven, are saying that we have to use genetic engineering and all of the tools of technology. That, I think, it fails to account for the enormous failure of science in many ways. You know, when DDT was invented, scientists proclaimed the end of pests, insect pests for us. When antibiotics were invented, that was going to be the conquest of infectious disease. You know, we have over and over again, we have claimed that we were going to do things, and the technology goes out and is effective in the real world where we are blindsided all the time.
However, you're not suggesting then that we should have done without antibiotics just because they weren't the magic bullet?
No, but the problem was that because we were suddenly faced with this, it was a miracle drug. I mean, I almost died of pneumonia in the 1940s. And when I was injected with penicillin, it was like a miracle. I mean, I was out of bed the next day. But like so many things, the drive for profit meant that the pharmaceutical company then took these very powerful drugs and pushed them where? Into animal feed. Oh, the vast bulk of antibiotics made today are not used to treat disease in people. They're used to feed chickens and cows and pigs because there's a slight gain in weight gain when you add antibiotics as a growth promoter in food. Well, that's resulted in an explosive spread of multiple resistant diseases all around the world.
We've been doing a bit of coverage of that issue here, and I think that it's the case that our poultry industry, for example, doesn't add quite as much as antibiotics to the food here that they do in the United States, or even you do in Canada, I don't know.
Good, there ought to be a total ban.
But they do say, look, they're not growth promotions, they are disease preventants, and if we didn't give them antibiotics, then they'd get sick and they'd fall over. And well, yes, the side product is gain in weight, but they're not growth promotions.
They're promoted as growth promoters, and it may very well be that you run low or you eliminate low-grade diseases. But, you know, there are other ways to grow chickens. Why do we need antibiotics? Because they're grown under conditions that are absolutely rife with difficulties of diseases and other problems when they're grown as battery chickens. There are other ways to grow them in a more humane way.
Are there other ways?
In a more healthy way.
Yeah. Are there other ways to grow chicken in the quantity that we, as a society, appear to need them?
It depends on whether you want to feed New Zealanders or whether you want to feed half the rest of the world. If you look at the global economy, of course, what you want to do is maximize your gain by selling to the entire world.
Well, it's not exactly maximizing gain. It's like making a buck, you know. I mean, in New Zealand, we need to sell stuff. That's what we do.
Right, but why do you have to have a global market where, in fact, with the kind of global economy that's being pushed on us, we push to the lowest possible standards? Why is it that farmers, I don't know about New Zealand, but in Canada, farmers are barely surviving in a time when food was never more important than now? Why? Because we're being undersold by farmers in Africa, in South America, in Asia, where, you know, what the heck are they doing undercutting our sales and growing food at such low cost? Because of the global economy that pushes profits up by selling to the lowest possible standard.
All right, so what's the answer?
I think the answer is that we've...
What's the question, first of all? Is the question, how do we halt globalization? Is that the question for you?
I'm all for globalization, as long as what we're globalizing are the highest possible standards of wages for farmers or for labor, of protection of workers in the workplace, of the highest possible standards of medical care and education. I want to globalize those. But what is the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank? What are they globalizing? They're globalizing the lowest possible denominator in terms of environmental protection, in terms of health care, medical care, all that protection of labor. What we're doing is we're driving down to the lowest possible level, and that's what you're competing with in New Zealand, in Canada, in the United States. It's nuts. Why are we doing that? We should be spreading the best standards, not having to compete with a third world country that doesn't have environmental legislation or worker protection.
But the fact is, that's the fact.
That's the way that our governments are buying into. But what is the anti-globalization movement? It's not a movement against globalizing good things. It's against globalization of what I've just said are destructive. Mm. And that's what I call good news. Until we get the WTO and organizations like that to realize that there are factors other than just maximizing profit and going to the lowest common denominator, they're going to continue to be as destructive as they are. But there's a huge movement around the world that is saying we don't want that.
The battle lines appear to be drawn, and environmentalists are almost necessarily on the other side from the globalization advocates. Is it necessary, if one is an environmentalist, to be against it? I mean, in the sense that it's used now, globalization, NAFTA, WTO.
Yes, well, if it depends on what the level your environmental awareness and concern is. If you're worried about maybe spraying chemicals in schoolyards or your backyards, that might be a different... You might have a different perspective on the global economy. But globalization is absolutely central to environmental issues that we face around the world. But the exciting thing is it's not just enviros or tree huggers that are involved in the anti-globalization movement. It's labor, it's indigenous people, it's human rights workers, it's farmers. You see this massive coalition of people from all sectors of society and many countries around the world.
The trouble with the massive coalition, and we saw it in Seattle, for example.
I was there.
Well, the trouble with the massive coalition is that they were very clear about what they were against. And they were against a whole bunch of things. A lot of it had very little to do with what happened in Seattle.
Are you talking about from experience of being there? I was there. All the stuff that you see in the media was about the antics of a few anarchists that were breaking down windows and protesting. In fact, thousands and thousands of people were sitting in an auditoria being lectured to. I gave two lectures that were never covered by the media. And this is where the bulk of the action was going on. People were being educated about what is globalization and what are the alternatives.
Well, tell me...
What are you talking about?
Tell me some of the alternatives then, given that... Globalization, we are promised, has already and will continue to bring greater prosperity to more people than has happened in the past. It ain't
first
perfect,
all,
but it's better.
That's a total lie.
All right, so what you got instead?
I've been told for 40 years that we need to have constant growth in the industrialized countries so that the benefits can trickle down to the poorer countries. We've lived through a period of unprecedented growth when the ratio of wealth in the richest 20% to the lowest 20% went from 29-1 to 60-1. And in that time, the disparity between the poor, not only between countries, but within even the industrialized countries, has continued to climb. The reality is, in a period of unprecedented economic growth, the wealth has been flowing upward to fewer and fewer people. We've won the war against poverty. We've beaten the poor into the ground. They've dropped off the agenda. The middle class, generally you find more and more two people in the family working, and they're moving backwards. They're working longer hours to try to stay in the same place. Meanwhile, the richest 5% are getting unbelievably rich. If that's what we want to globalize, then I think people ought to be up at the ramparts.
It seems almost impossible, however, to halt it. I mean, you know from your own experience,
well,
Canada's
what are you
membership
advocating?
Of NAFTA.
That we just give up then?
I'm not advocating anything, Dr. Suzuki.
I don't get it.
I'm asking you what you've got to mobilize sufficient people to make a dent in globalization, which is a very
hundreds
powerful movement.
Hundreds of thousands of people have been showing up at Genoa, at Quebec City, at, I gather, Melbourne, in Seattle. September 9th kind of brought that to a halt. It's going to come back. That is a very, very broad-based movement. And believe me, the WTO is finally beginning to get the picture. You can't deal with issues affecting people and ecosystems around the world do it behind closed doors without regard to an electorate. The protesters have had a huge impact. But now is the time to drive home the changes. We need to get changes in that.
And you want changes within the WTO, or do you envisage an organization that will provide some kind of opposition to the WTO?
Well, it would be very, very nice if there was a way to balance the WTO. If you look at the original terrible triplets, the IMF, the World Bank, and the ITO, the ITO was supposed to be an elected body. This is back in 45, an elected body that was to counter, to represent the people and counter the multinational corporations. The United States got rid of the ITO and basically created organizations that prostrate themselves before the American economy. But there was a plan, even back in the 40s, to have a counter to the kind of goings-on of the IMF and the World Bank. Now the WTO has simply reinforced that behind-closed-doors decisions made by unelected people.
So if you just get the WTO to change itself a little bit according to the demands of some of the people at Seattle, for example, then you've got, you know, the kind of manufacturing consent scenario that you're very well familiar with.
I don't know whether that's the ultimate scenario. We would like to democratize the decision-making and make people realize that there is more than just economics. Economics driven by the need to maximize profit is not enough. It's a very destructive drive. We've got to get a vision of what is an economy for and what kind of a world and a society are we driving towards 20, 30, 40 years down the line.
So if the situation is this bad and if the forces are so powerful, how hard does the individual have to try to change the things? What are the ethics and the morality of protest here in your mind?
It's up to every person to decide for themselves. I can't prescribe what's needed. You start your sentence by saying, if it's as bad as it seems. Well, you know, that's a very important issue. Is it just an if? Are we still debating how bad it is? What I advise people is this. You don't have to listen to Greenpeace or David Suzuki or anybody else. Just verify it for yourself. Ask anyone who's 80 or 90 years old, living wherever they've lived for that time, what was it like when you were a child? And I've done this wherever I go, whether it's in the Serengeti, in the Amazon, whether it's in Japan or Southeast Asia. I ask people, elders, what it's like. And everywhere they say the same thing. It used to be so different. There used to be forests, there used to be fish, there used to be trees. All over the world, our elders are a living record of enormous changes that have happened in the span of a single human life. Now, do you think that's sustainable? Because we have now a mighty economic engine that is driving to continue to maximize profit, to continue to grow, and that growth, believe me, is at the expense of what our elders remember the world was like when they were young. Use your eyes, use your senses, and confirm it through your elders. We are on an unsustainable path. So the issue is not if it's as serious as it is. The issue is, what do we do now? We have grandchildren. We have a commitment into the future. What kind of a world are we leaving them? And it's not enough to leave it to a political bottom line, which is, when is the next election? Or a business bottom line, which used to be the annual report, but is now the quarterly report. This is not long-term vision. We need to get back on there. A vision and a question like, what are economies for, who should benefit, and where are we going?
Dr. David Suzuki, who was in New Zealand for the Readers and Writers Week. It's 26 minutes past 11. Quick email, more about Murray Weatherson's tax story. It's all very well for right-wing taxpayers to illustrate tax as a free meal at a restaurant, but there are innumerable flaws with the comparison. Large companies are capable of causing significant impacts on communities, and the cost of restraining legislation should properly be borne by them when this occurs. In the case of the fishing industry, large companies persuaded government to create a quota management system, which has put the fishery substantially in the hands of the four largest players. The dispossessed small fishermen now earn nothing, and so can pay no tax. The companies instead employ foreign fishermen, who pay no tax. The remaining taxpayers must pay out approximately $2 billion in Waitangi settlements to pay for the illegal derogation of the treaty caused by the quota management system. No theoretical tax discussion is equal to the issues of corporate mala fide. 28 minutes past 11.